Hello and welcome to another edition of Sibylline Insights, recorded on Wednesday the 5th of July from our central London offices. I'm Gareth Westwood, Head of Global Intelligence here at Sibylline, and I'm delighted today to be joined by our co-host for today's edition, Sydney Stewart from the Americas Desk. How are you, Sydney?
I'm very well, Gareth. How are you?
Really good. It's been quite busy. We've got a load to get through today. We've got Ukraine, of course. We've got Guatemala, France, Israel, climate. Not sure if we'll get through it all, but before we do, we just did a great interview with our colleague Riccardo Cucciani from the Asia Pacific desk. We were talking about some of the restrictions on businesses in China as a result of their various cybersecurity and data protection laws. So do stay tuned for that. We'll be showing that a little bit later. But before we get to that, Sydney, let's first look at how busy have we been for the last 2 weeks, particularly the Europe and Eurasia desk. All started a couple of Fridays ago when a former hot dog salesman attempted a coup or a mutiny or a march in Russia. What on earth went on there?
So just over a week ago, hard to imagine it was only over a week ago, but Yevgeny Prigozhin, the leader of Wagner Group.
That's the PMC, right?
Yeah. Private military company, led a mutiny and a march on Moscow of all of his troops. This was over discontent in Ukraine and alleged targeting by the Russian military of positions held by a Wagner Group in Ukraine. So ultimately, the Wagner Group led a march from southern Russia up towards Moscow, but ultimately what would have been likely a coup or a coup attempt was halted while the Belarusian president brokered a deal between Prigozhin and the Kremlin.
So, I mean, it was quite quick, wasn't it? I mean, it actually didn't last much longer than a Wagner opera, in all honesty. 24 hours later, this deal that apparently the Belarusian president brokered, that resulted in Prigozhin going back to Belarus, seemingly in exile.
Yeah, it was reported that, in fact, Prigozhin did arrive in Belarus last Tuesday, but his exact whereabouts are, of course, unknown. Meanwhile, in the intervening time, he's released several voice messages on Telegram channels, taunting journalists and inviting support for Wagner Group.
And of course, we produced a load of reports on that weekend, you remember, and we did a special Ukraine webinar, which we do twice a week, but I think we did an extended one on that Monday. And a lot of the questions were around, you know, when will Prigozhin find himself accidentally falling out of an eighth floor window? However, there are implications here, I think, for Russia, right? For the regime. I mean, we've got the election coming up. Who's to say that what will happen there, will Putin be kind of shown the door? Have these cracks emerged that are now going to be exploited by other partners? Because, of course, as Alexander Lord from our Eurasia desk has said consistently, what comes after Putin is potentially a lot worse. So it remains to be seen what the long-term impact, but there's undoubtedly a long-term impact here. But, I mean, pivoting to Ukraine, you've been having a quick look at yesterday's Ukraine report. Mm-hmm. That's business as usual, right? This seemingly hasn't affected it that much.
Well, we've seen reports that Ukraine is off to a soft start of its spring counteroffensive. But I think in the short term, the impact of the Wagner saga in Russia is that, you know, rising domestic political instability in Russia is going to yield, I think, greater unpredictability on the field in Ukraine, particularly ahead of that election, as Putin becomes more desperate for a win to capitalize on and to maintain his grip on power. We also have in Ukraine the Zaporizhia nuclear power plant. It's suspected that Russian forces have planted mines in the cooling waters around the plant.
Right, and we've heard a lot more about Zaporizhia since this potential coup, right? Mm-hmm. So that's quite worrying, because I think of all the nuclear kind of Armageddon scenarios that our desks produce, I think the Zaporizhia thing going up is, I think, the most likely. I could be corrected. Sorry, Alex, if you're listening. But yeah, worrying times.
Yeah, I think there's growing concern in the immediate term that Russia could be planning a potential attack against Zaporizhia, given that they pulled all of their personnel from the facility recently. And there are IAEA inspectors that remain on the ground. in the meantime, but certainly an incidental meltdown is something to be concerned about.
Extremely, a huge strategic effects. And in the meantime, you know, we've had the US head of the military coming out, or head of the army, I might be wrong, come out and say that, look, Ukraine isn't all in for its counteroffensive yet. So I think, you know, just uncertainty ahead. Interesting times. We do a bi-weekly Ukraine webinar, daily Ukraine reporting. We have to draw a line under it there, but anybody who is interested, I'd urge them to sign up for those webinars.
Mm-hmm. So Gareth, I think you also wanted to talk about France, of course.
Yeah, absolutely. So amongst the recent crazy videos of zoo animals parading the street.
In fact, Gareth, I believe that has been fact checked. There was misinformation swirling that a gorilla had been released from a zoo by rioters. And in fact, it was false. I'm sorry to tell you.
Well, that's welcome. I think on a serious note, it's the last thing France needs at the minute is gorillas running around the streets. Because just as we're seeing the protests die down, we need to be reminded that the fractures in society that created the latest kind of round of riots go way further back than the most recent incident. I mean, 30 years ago, remember that young man getting beaten up by police during an incident which also predicated riots. But let's look at what's recently happened, right? A young lad was shot, a 17-year-old man was shot during a routine traffic stop. Now, there are conflicting stories around that, but actually what followed is what we're probably here to talk about, the days of riots and looting that proliferated not only Paris, but the rest of France. Probably the worst riots we've seen since 2005.
Yeah.
Now, obviously, the Europe desk have been looking at this closely. I know you were talking to our colleagues on the Europe desk. They seem to have died down a bit. Am I mistaken?
Yeah. So as of right now, protests have declined in each subsequent night. So far, there have been six nights of protest. But still, you're seeing in the hundreds of people being arrested, even though this is still, you know, a relative decline in overall unrest and violence. It remains likely that in the coming days, there will still be violent protests concentrated in places like Paris and Lyon and Marseille. And isolated clashes are possible with law enforcement, but hopefully things will die down. I think what is notable about this case is the tack that President Macron has taken. It's markedly different from the tack taken by Jacques Chirac in 2005 protests. Mm. In 2005, Chirac basically wrote off protests and used disparaging terms to speak about protesters and their causes for unrest. We've seen Macron take a more empathetic approach and kind of a more, an approach that will hopefully yield, he will hopefully help to diffuse the situation rather than exacerbate and spur further protests. But of course, on the 14th of July, we have Bastille Day coming up, and this might be a possible trigger for further protest in the public.
Yeah, and I mean, you know, I think the root cause won't go away anytime soon, right? So I think you're absolutely right to point out to listeners and clients the flashpoints. And of course, our Europe desk is all over that, and we'll keep tabs on indicators and warnings, because these were particularly hostile. I mean, you had a coalescing of different interest groups, and even, you know, journalists were seen as representative of the state. That those who were the target of violence in many cases, it was pretty tenuously, linked to the state. So a real non-trivial bystander risk, I think, going forward.
Absolutely. As you said, like these protests have been triggered by a particular incident, but are precipitated by long-standing socioeconomic and ethno-religious divides within France. And, you know, those latent tensions within the society are not going to be remedied in the near term.
Busy time for our Europe and Eurasia desk, no doubt.
Indeed.
So, Sydney, going to our Middle East and Africa desk, obviously our Middle East, North Africa and Turkey sub-regional desk has been concentrating a lot on Israel all year and before that, it seems. However, this latest IDF operation in Jenin triggered an alert that we put out on Monday, a couple of days ago as we're recording this. And it was essentially Israeli Defense Force operation targeting quote unquote terrorists, Palestinian militants in a refugee camp. This operation involved airstrikes as well, targeted apparently, according to the Israeli government. And it just stoked further the tension that the Netanyahu administration seems to be garnering, or at least tensions that exist in light of his presidency. So it looks like it's potentially dying down, but there's been arrests. I think there might have been casualties. What can you tell us about that? I know you've been looking at it.
Yeah, I was just speaking to Valeria Scuto, who's one of our principal Middle East, North Africa, Turkey analyst, and she gave considerable insight into the case. She noted that in the IDF operation, they use drone strikes, which is actually a new trend that has been observed in recent months. So a bit of a kind of, you know, departure from perhaps the typical modus operandi of the IDF in this sort of operations. And also notable is that Hamas has taken a more prominent role rhetorically and in action as well. Hamas had taken responsibility for the car ramming incident in Tel Aviv that resulted in several casualties and injuries over the weekend. And despite limited rocket fire from Gaza, the desk is not assessing that there's going to be a massive barrage in the very near term. Another point that Valeria made that I thought was very insightful was this was not an unanticipated move by, you know, Netanyahu's right-wing government. The question was not if so much as when they might take such an opportunity. And since the operation, Netanyahu has signaled that this is not a one-off and that we can, you know, expect similar operations in the near to medium term. So with that, I think there's, you know, a likelihood in the medium to long term for sustained, you know, conflict.
And you know, this is dying down now. And seemingly we have these flare-ups and not one incident results in kind of, you know, the next intifada, which we've been asked about several times, but it's a death by a thousand cuts. And, you know, it will cease to have strategic effect until it does, I think.
Yeah.
And I know the desk are very keen to not look at these incidents isolated, look at them in the round, and we continue to obviously provide indicators and warnings for when.
Yeah.
Things could get more impacted strategically. But I mean, you know, even I seem to remember a couple of years ago, a flare-up that resulted in border closures between, you know, Gaza and Israel that resulted in, I know several clients had cold chain logistics with pharmaceuticals kept at the border, subsequently lost millions of dollars. So, you know, whilst this stuff is dying down, our desk are really keen to cite the implications, quite profound implications of each incident, while at the same time keeping half an eye on that more strategic piece. So tragic to hear some of the stories from the ground, but you know, I think we need to draw a line under that. Now we're running out of time because a couple of days ago, as I'm recording this, it was Monday the 3rd, I believe. It was the hottest average temperature. Global average temperature on record, I believe, 17 degrees Celsius. Not sure what that is in Fahrenheit for our transatlantic consumer. You can look that up. As you're American, you should know this, Sydney. But yeah, I know you recently wrote a climate special looking at the implications for organizations, individuals and businesses going forward in the short and medium term. What were some of the conclusions that you arrived at in that special, very briefly?
I mean, the bottom line in that special report was that the confluence of climate risks is going to lead to an increasingly complex operating environment for organizations and an increasingly complex environment for people to navigate their day-to-day lives. And it's not going to cease anytime soon. On the contrary, we're going to continue to see overlapping and interconnected risks where you might have heat waves that that bring down power grids and rotating power outages, or meanwhile you have wildfires, and these come together to create really an urgent and crisis scenario for local communities. And additionally, we plan in September to release a subsequent edition of the Climate Special, where we will expand it beyond the US and Canada, which is what I focus on for this NORTHAM special report, but we'll do a global focus for the next one.
And to be clear, we're not going into the ways, whys, and hows of climate change, or the man-made climate change versus versus other sides of the argument. We're just looking at actually what's happening on the ground and what implications it has for businesses, which is why I found your report really quite interesting, quite intriguing. And I know we did push it out on LinkedIn. I think my producer will tell me definitely did push it out on LinkedIn. So that's available. It's in the ether. Really interesting reading. And what I failed to mention is also we pushed out, going all the way back to the beginning, a Ukraine special. Just reminded me, we pushed that out on LinkedIn and various social media platforms as well. So I encourage folks listening to try and find that. We'll try and push it out again, maybe after the pod. We had a load of other stuff to cover, Guatemala, Sudan, but we're going to have to leave it there and come back to these issues. We're now going to go to the interview for today. But before we do, thank you so much, Sydney. It's been great having you on and look forward to seeing you again.
Thank you so much, Gareth.
Now, since 2015, the People's Republic of China has launched an array of national security and cybersecurity data protection legislation in order to seemingly protect itself from harm. However, these have had serious implications for businesses. Now, throughout the last few weeks, and indeed few months, Sibylline's been monitoring this with some diligence, it's fair to say, and we've actually produced quite a number of reports. This was punctuated last Friday with a report from the National Counterintelligence and Security Center in the US, which sought to underline a number of these potential pitfalls that businesses could fall into. So to discuss that and the context of this, as well as ongoing potential implications, I am delighted to be joined by Ricardo Cucciani. Ricardo, thank you very much for coming on the pod.
Thank you for having me.
So let's start with what we've been covering for, I think you said the last few weeks or months, actually. I seem to remember a number of reports, daily reports, some special reports as well, that covered these areas of legislation. Can you just briefly summarize what we've been putting out over the last few weeks and months?
Sure, we've actually been covering not only the new amended counter-espionage law, but also all the issues surrounding it, including arbitrary detentions and investigation against US and foreign due diligence firms over the past few months, including since February, when the first reports of police investigation into the US consultancy firm Mintz Group were released. There were clear signs that there were some changes coming in the short term. We've been following it since then. And ever since the new law was approved, the new amended law was approved in late April of this year, I've been covering through dailies, a few weeklies, monthlies. We put out a few alerts, and we'll definitely continue to follow through over the next few weeks to see what the law culminates into, if there will be any new additional investigations or reports or anything like that.
So you highlighted one or two key alerts that we sent out there on the Mintz Group, as well, as you said. So we've been over this for quite some time. Why did the US government issue this alert late on Friday, and why are we reacting to it now?
I think the alert coincides with the enactment of the law, which took effect on Saturday, the 1st of July. And I think they were simply warning their own businesses and the foreign business community of these new changes. It's been somewhat of a contentious legislation. The issue's been brought up by the US. Sorry, let me start that. Yeah. So the law has been a contentious issue. There have been a few foreign businesses raising concerns over the implementation of the law, but also, most importantly, the expanded definition of what constitutes national interest and intelligence and state secrets. And so I think this has definitely worsened foreign business climates and confidence, particularly foreign investors' confidence into China. Although ironically, despite the fact that since the removal of China's COVID-19 restrictions late last year, government officials have, you know, they've sought to promote trade and foreign investments. However, these sort of actions, such as this new amended law, will most likely run counter to that. So China is actually somewhat a bit schizophrenic in this. They want to maintain trade relations and positive relations, you know, outside of its borders. But at the same time, they are somewhat creating an environment that is becoming increasingly hostile for these businesses, or at least it's becoming perceived as such.
That's really interesting. So, I mean, there are so many implications, and so we've got the counter-espionage law, the personal information protection law, there's something on sanctions, cybersecurity, data security. We could talk about this all day. But there are a raft of implications here for mm-hmm. folks that are doing business in China, multinationals that may have offices in China, you know, retail leisure facilities that have hotels in China. Can you highlight some of the main implications of these laws? I know there's so many of them, but if you can just kind of parse mm-hmm. out the main things that organizations and businesses need to be concerned about in the short term.
Absolutely. I'll start by saying that the core issue with regards to these new amendments concern uncertainties. This law definitely raises uncertainties when conducting business in China, and particularly firms, for example, including our own sector in China, due diligence and consultancies, whereby due to the new amendments, basically anything that constitutes a national interest, which is open to definition, it's very likely purposefully left vague as such to allow pretty much any sort of interpretation by courts. So anyone collecting, storing, and disseminating this information, including outside of Chinese borders, could be classified as a foreign agent, as a spy. The new amendments also state that anyone found to be colluding with a foreign intelligence organization, again, I guess, knowingly or unknowingly, could be classified as a foreign agent, and so a spy, and that person's activity could be constituted as counter espionage. But again, it remains to be seen exactly and understood what will constitute as intelligence and national interest. It could be interpreted as anything, including in the open source.
Just research?
Anybody that conducts such research and activities in China, including academic research or, again, our own sort of research in our own sector, if they were to research and then disseminate that information on, say, things like political, domestic political affairs, anything that concerns, I guess, the military could be classified as such, but also including policy process, economic data. It's very much uncertain and unclear. So I guess whatever the security authorities and courts were to define national interest and security as such, and anything within their realm could be classified as intelligence and so would trigger the law. But one important thing here is that despite the expansion of the definition and the expansion of action that the security authorities can take, I don't think it really changes that much what the practicality, what the reality actually is.
They've always been doing this, right? This is not a new thing, Ricardo.
Exactly,
it?
More or less. So I think the promulgation of the new amendments, it also serves not only to bolster the security apparatus's capabilities against perceived or real threats and risks, but also has a role to signal both domestically and abroad that China is bolstering up its security and defenses against this type of threats.
So symbolic move to kind of publish these amendments, etc. But actually, the mitigations that are listeners, clients will be used to operating in China, you know, in terms of their clean communications devices, etc. Nothing really changes.
Yes and no, I would say. In practicality, I don't think it really bring that many changes to what security authorities, including the police, can do, for they've already been doing that for a long time. What changes, though, is that because of the expansion of the definition of national security and intelligence, expanding into the realms of what we consider everyday business. Now it means that everyday business could be classified as risky intelligence espionage business, but it remains to be seen exactly who will come under fire from it. So it's very likely that any related investigations triggered by this law will be very much arbitrary. This appears to be the case of what we've seen over the past few months with regards to US due diligence firms, the ones that I mentioned. So it looks like that sector has been targeted in particular. It remains to be seen if other sectors will be targeted as well. I personally remain doubtful that the law would have some sort of have an umbrella effect over every single industry. But that would be counterproductive and would be counter to Chinese economic interests.
But it's not really knowable, is it? As you say, it's quite arbitrary. Due diligence, corporate intelligence, of course, you could second guess that. But could be anybody, right? And just before we finish, does this pose also a threat to those folks visiting China who might be involved in research or activity counter to what Chinese security authorities find acceptable? For example, you know, in firms like ours, we have folks, you know, from China in consulting firms, for example, say the Minsk Group that was, you know, that had that incident a few months ago, or any other due diligence or consulting firm. Say, had I know a Chinese executive or somebody on the board of Chinese origin, and they've been particularly hawkish on China in their research, would they then face any sanction to go into China, or would they actually, as soon as they land in China, would there be anything more worrying, like an arrest or an interrogation? What do you see in that space?
I think such a risk has pretty much always been there. I think the new legislation and the accompanying changing climate and perception has definitely changed, and that risk has increased, relatively speaking. By how much, I can't really say from here, but these changes have definitely contributed to heightened sensitivities and anxieties of this sort. I think overall visitors, including tourists, are also people in our sector visiting, are still pretty much safe overall. Again, it's very hard to tell what this will look like and who will be targeted. But again, it's summarize it as more or less the same, just slightly more.
And we have a number of partners, friends, clients that are in the NGO sector or the nonprofit sector. I know I'm shooting from the hip here, Ricardo, but I know an NGO that might have been critical on, you know, a contentious issue, the Uyghurs or Tibet or something like that. You know, do you think this law would extend to that sector as well and to those individuals?
Yes, definitely. But again, the work legislations and practices in the past prior to the changes that were brought up into law, these sectors were already somewhat targeted. We're still operating within those realms and realities. Again, I think the key issue here is to understand where the sort of red line are, and this law has definitely made them a lot thinner and has definitely lowered the limit as to what could constitute as an illegal act. But again, I think it remains to be seen because again, the law is so vague and can be so expansive that can be applied to anything. But doing so would be counterproductive to a lot of other of China's own interests.
And I was going to stop there, but just one final question, because it's really fascinating. We saw during Balloon Gate, which I believe we covered, you know, the disconnect between, in that case, it was the intelligence services and the diplomatic arm, with Tony Blinken's council visit. Could we foresee a situation here where the security arm is not really speaking to the international trade arm? And despite one's best efforts to, you know, balance the two, we could see one overtaking the other. Could we see more hawkish security activity in China? I'm just wondering, you know, you say there's this disconnect, there's this cognitive dissonance between wanting to open up and do trade and yet highlight the restrictive security practices. Are they speaking to each other, these departments?
That's a really good question. I don't think anybody really has a clear answer to it unless you're working, you know, within the Chinese government. But I would say there are most likely some issues where not every department that should be talking to one another is actually talking to one another. I can also envision cases where, because of national security, intelligence, and state secret concerns, such departments cannot actually talk to others. So if that's the case, then I think it's only a matter of time. You know, it's a very strong possibility that such incidents will occur again. When they will occur, what they will look like, who will be affected by it, still remains to be seen. But again, that risk, I think, will continue to be there.
Well, whilst everyone's looking at the Taiwan Strait, we are, of course, looking at that, but as well following this issue with, as you say, quite consistent line of reporting. And should things change, escalate, or otherwise, we'll be sure to bring you on again. But for now, thank you so much for being on the podcast.
Thank you for having me.
So that's it for another edition of Sibline Insights. Huge thank you to Ricardo Cucciani from our Asia Pacific desk. And of course, thanks to my co-host, Sydney Stewart. Please do remember to like and subscribe however you got this podcast, and we look forward to welcoming you next time.